The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td at kpcg.fm. On today's program, a little bit later on in the show, you might recall some of you a couple of months ago, I think it was, when we got into this example from Herbert Armstrong's autobiography on Isaiah 58 and verse 1, the commission that he felt like God had given him to get out there and to cry aloud with God's warning message. And today I'd like to continue on with that chapter. The entire chapter, actually, is a wonderful study of what kind of attitude it takes to really get out there and to proclaim God's truth and to give that loving warning. Also today I'd like to just get into some of the follow on, I guess, to some extent from what we touched on Friday, just getting ready for the the next year, the next calendar year, 2017. If you heard Friday's show, it's on our website, thetrumpet.com, or at the kpcg.fm site. Are you ready for when the 10 kings come together? So much is happening, and we've got a few more items following on that program that I think will tie in. Well, I'm coming to you today from our headquarters studio. I was in traveling all day yesterday, arriving from the UK in Minneapolis to begin with, where I think the pilot said it was -8 degrees, and then coming down here to Oklahoma, it's not really that much warmer. A frigid cold spell moving across the United States, and to be sure, we haven't had anything like this in the UK, not this winter or last winter, the two winters that I've been there. So it was an abrupt awakening to some of the extreme weather conditions that you have in the Midwest of the United States in particular. While I was traveling, by the way, I was able to get through a little bit from this book. It's not a new book. I think it's maybe 7-8 years old. But it's by Nicholas Wapshot, who wrote a book back 7-8 years ago on Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, a political marriage, as he called it. And I think most of you are aware of just how close the ties were between the United States and Britain during that time period, during the 1980s. And I didn't really have time to assemble any clips yet, but I'd like to come back to it if I can, maybe for a later a program down the road, because it is really remarkable what, I guess, Thatcher came into office about 20 months before Reagan was voted in I guess 1980, and then the inauguration was in 81. And then I believe Margaret Thatcher was the first world leader to come and visit Ronald Reagan. And I mean, from the beginning, these two had a special affection for one another. And he even broke, the president did, broke with protocol in how he went over and above to really single out her and the United Kingdom. And as opposed to just trying to keep it on more of a level playing field, which, as you know, from President Obama, he's gone quite to the other extreme to break up those ties with some of the more traditional allies in all because he feels like, well, it's got to be the same with everyone else. Well, these two made no bones about the fact that there was a special relationship between the United States and Britain. And when Mrs. Thatcher came over to visit with the new president in 1981, I mean, she echoed what Winston Churchill had said about that if we two stand together, we'll be able to solve any problems in this world. And they looked at what was happening with the Soviet Union and that as a grave threat. And the United States and Britain needed to come together to counter that. Well, the other thing, I guess, that stands out when you read that is it just seems like almost like ancient history. You talk about how different the world is today. And this was just some 30 years ago, 30, 35 years ago. And what a different world we're in now. My father wrote, well, he's written a number of times about that passage in Revelation 10, verse 6 in particular, which says that we're living in a time of no more delay. And he said that we entered into that time there in the late 1980s. Satan was cast down at or around January 16th, 1986. And then there was a period where the work stopped. And then God raised up the ruins. And when Malachi's message came out there in late 1989, we entered into a period of no more delay, as it says in Revelation 10. And then you look at all of the events that have happened since that time period, since 1986 to begin with, or since 1989. My father wrote this in one of the earlier versions of the Habakkuk booklet. I didn't get the exact year, but this is from many, many years ago. He just kind of summarized that critical time period in the Habakkuk booklet. He says, the split in God's church occurred in December 1989, 1 month after the Berlin Wall came down in Germany, paving the way for Germany's reunification. It says, Germany is now becoming the financial powerhouse of the world. The Holy Roman Empire is ready to burst onto the world scene. The 10 nations are almost in place. This is what we were talking about on Friday. We've got to get ready for it. He says, all that has to happen is for someone to tie it all together. And when that happens, the greatest time of human suffering will begin with the collapse of the USSR. The Berlin Wall, as he says there, came down in 1989. And it cleared the way for what we see now in Europe moving forward rapidly. That's what my father wrote in one of his older booklets. This is from GermanForeignPolicy.com just from yesterday. One of their email alerts on the European War Union says the EU will significantly increase some of these details we've gone through in recent programs. But as I've said before, German Foreign Policy does a great job in just kind of summarizing the events of the last couple of weeks to show just how fast it's moving. The EU will significantly increase the number of its military interventions. This was one of the results of the EU Heads of State and Government Summit meeting held yesterday in Brussels. So this must have been on Saturday. It says the member countries will also intensify cooperation of their armed forces. This coincides with demands repeatedly put forward by the German government during its campaign launched last summer to promote the militarization of the EU. As I say, we touched on this last week. GermanForeignPolicy.com says recently, after the EU defense ministers, along with other bodies, including the European Parliament, passed several resolutions, the EU Commission published a defense action plan, which provides for annual expenditures from a European defense fund of €500 million for weapons research beginning in the early 2020s. Most recently, the European Parliament called for the EU to upgrade its military to be able to use its full potential as a world power. That's a quote from the European Parliament. It says the objective, according to Hans-Peter Bartels, Parliamentary Commissioner for the German Armed Forces, is to establish an EU army. That's the objective. They're not exactly trying to conceal it anymore. Our objective is to establish an EU army. Over the weekend, by the way, you may have seen it on the website, but the television program for in the UK, Superpower Europe, it's one of the stronger programs, I think, that we've put on the air there. In fact, we submitted it hoping that they didn't give us too much flack. And it advertised the Holy Roman Empire in prophecy and also the Royal Book of Revelation. Now, the Holy Roman Empire in prophecy is a book we've advertised, I think, three or four times already. So some of the viewers were probably already had that one. But in any event, it brought in 158 responses. So it was a solid response to a program about all of these events as they speed up in Europe, superpower Europe. That video just kind of summarized some of the subjects we've been covering daily on this program. Well, you go back to that history, 1989, as I say, that history, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, a political marriage. It seems like such a long time ago. Look at what's happened since, though. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, as my father covered in that excerpt I just read. The Soviet Union crumbles, as he said in that excerpt, paving the way for a newly united and powerful Europe. And then since that time, well, look at the European Union today. Germany's been pushing for a military. That's what we want from this, an EU military. And now Russia, which crumbled in 1989, 1990, 1991, that critical period. Look at where Russia is today. Gary Kasparov, the famous chess champion and also outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin, he had a piece in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend titled "The USSR Fell and the World Fell Asleep." He says the USSR, this is from the Wall Street Journal, it ceased to exist in 1991, but there are plenty of repressive authoritarian regimes thriving in 2016. The difference, and I'm sad to say it, is that the citizens of the free world don't much care about dictatorships anymore or about the 2.7 billion people who still live in them. There's still 2.7 billion people living under a dictatorship. And yet for most people, well, really, a lot of these dictators, like with Fidel Castro, they win a lot of support from the West, Western journalists and leaders, liberals, who like what they're doing in these dictatorships. Look at the praise that Vladimir Putin gets from many in the West. 2.7 billion people still living under a dictatorship. Kasparov says here, the words of John F. Kennedy in 1963, Berlin, sound naive to most Americans today. He said, freedom is indivisible, and when one man is enslaved, all are not free. It says that for decades, the U.S. government based effective foreign policy on such lofty ideals seems as distant as a world without iPhones. I mean, for decades, that was the foreign policy. Freedom is indivisible, and when one man is enslaved, all are not free. I mean, when Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher came together, that's why they wanted to bring down the Soviet Union, to make freedom available for all people. In fact, Kasparov quotes Reagan in this piece. He says, Ronald Reagan's warning that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction was never meant to be put to the test, but it is being tested now. If anything, Reagan's time frame of a generation was far too generous. I mean, just take Russia as one example. As Kasparov says here, in 1991, the USSR ceased to exist. And when did Vladimir Putin come into power? 9 years later. 9 years later. He says here, the dramatic expansion of freedom that occurred 25 years ago may be coming undone in 25 months. See, that's what we're really looking at here. events, dramatic events that are happening at lightning pace, lightning speed. All of these dramatic events that seemed so good 25 years ago. I mean, who wasn't cheering the fall of the Berlin Wall? When Ronald Reagan saw that wall for the first time, he said, that has to come down. It has to come down. People have to have freedom. That really motivated a lot of the U.S. foreign policy for decades. John F. Kennedy on through to Ronald Reagan and so on. It says here, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the USSR was the end of watch for the anti-communist coalition formed by Harry Truman after World War II. A year later, baby boomer Bill Clinton was making jokes with Russia's President Boris Yeltsin. And it was time to party, not press the advantage. Kasparov says the U.S. had unrivaled global power and influence more than any other time in history. Yet instead of using it to shape a new global framework to protect and project the values of democracy and human rights, as Truman had done immediately to put Stalin in check, the free world acted as though the fight had been won once and for all. Well, we won the battle. We won the fight. We won the war, and now we can dance with President Yeltsin. Now we can have fun and party. The war's over. The United States won. As for Russia, Kasparov says here, President Yeltsin saw no advantage in rebuilding robust institutions that might challenge his authority. This led to corruption under his administration, but it had far more severe consequences when someone far more ruthless replaced him. And that's what happened. That's what happened when Vladimir Putin came to power in the year 2000. Kasparov says he found few obstacles capable of resisting his instinct to remake Russia in his own KGB image. And that's what he set out to do. And he said so proudly. We're going to rebuild the Russian Empire. Kasparov says he also found a Russian public that felt betrayed by the promises of democracy and afraid of the violence and corruption we all saw around us. Mr. Putin's vulgar rhetoric of security and national pride would have worn thin quickly had the price of oil not begun to skyrocket in the new millennium. And so he goes on to explain how that they basically, so many of the Russian people, were happy enough to give up their freedom in return for stability. It says every step Mr. Putin took without consequences encouraged him to take another and another. And that's what he's been doing. Every step that he takes down this path to authoritarianism, there have been no consequences. And so he's just encouraged to do more. It says outside Russia, at every turn, Europe and the U.S. failed to provide the leadership the historic moment required. And it just shows how he took advantage of everything that was in place there. Russia was declared the successor of the USSR with little argument, even being awarded a coveted spot in the G7 in 1997. So the USSR ceases to exist in 91. It's awarded this coveted spot on the G7. Putin comes along in 2000 and says, thanks very much. I'll take that gift, as Kasparov says here, to validate my democratic credentials and then use it against the West. It says, even today, members of the Western democratic establishment praise Mr. Putin as a strong leader as he enters his 17th year of total power in an imploding Russia that millions have fled. See, it's just like with Castro in Cuba. The same thing. Says the bedrock belief of the Cold War that the U.S. and the rest of the free world would be safer and stronger by promoting human rights and democracy has been abandoned in the West in favor of engagement and moral equivalence. Last week we showed you that with that clip from, what was it, about a year ago with President-elect Donald Trump on MSNBC making the moral equivalence argument in support of Vladimir Putin. When the journalist, you know, said, look, he does a lot of evil, violent things. And Mr. Trump responded by saying, well, I think our country does plenty of killing also. And now we have, assuming he gets through, a new Secretary of State that's bragged about having a very close relationship with Vladimir Putin. Someone who's entering his 17th year of total power in a Russia that's imploding. It used to be, as Kasparov brings out, it used to be that the United States, and you see this clearly in the book A Political Marriage, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, that bedrock belief that the U.S. and the rest of the free world would be safer and stronger by promoting human rights and democracy. I mean, we've abandoned that idea. And now it's all about engagement. It's all about befriending the enemies. It's all about moral equivalence. You have Barack Obama with his big, I guess his last big presser on Friday. Basically, you know, he didn't claim Syria as a victory, but he didn't necessarily say he did anything wrong there either. Or with the way he's worked with Russia. I mean, no real big mistakes. As we've reached out to these nations, Iran, Russia, it's quite a bit different. What a different world compared to the way it was just 25, 30 years ago. Kasparov says here, the people I met in the West in the 1980s, listen to this. Here he was, a famous chess player, traveling the world. He says, the people I met in the West in the 1980s were intensely curious about the Soviet Union, even if they called us all Russians. Cold War enmity led to a great deal of mythologizing, but there is also sincere concern for the hundreds of millions of people living behind the Iron Curtain. He traveled throughout the West, and just the general sentiment, people were concerned by those living behind the Iron Curtain, by those living, about those living under the thumb of a dictator. Kasparov says Westerners often asked how they could help, something that is rarely heard in today's environment of appeasement and isolationism. Today, well, we're to praise Castro. We're to praise Putin. Well, what about all these evil acts? Well, we do evil acts too. Everyone does it. We're all friends. We've got to reach out to each other. We're partners. We're trade partners. We've got to make money together. That's what it boils down to. People showed concern. This is Kasparov's take when he traveled the world in the 1980s. Westerners asking him, is there anything we can do to help? It's not heard today in this environment. Appeasement and isolationism. It says a time when dictatorship is not seen as a discrete problem, when in fact it is the dominant crisis that enables so many others, including war, terror, and refugees. The architects of the Cold War understood that there could be no lasting peace unless the Soviet Union was contained and opposed at every turn. I mean, that was Reagan's policy in a nutshell. More than that, I mean, the policy of containment was there before Reagan came along, but he opposed it. He wanted to bring it down. And even many in his own administration thought that was far-fetched in the 1980s. It'll never happen. We've just got to draw the line and make sure it doesn't expand. And Reagan comes in and says, forget about expansion or stopping the expansion. We're going to send them back in reverse. That lesson has been forgotten along with so many others. Well, Kasparov says, along the way, a lot of people have asked him, why didn't you defect? Why didn't you go to a Western nation? And he explains in this piece that he didn't do that because he wanted to use his fame. I mean, he did have some favor from the Russian government because he was so famous. And so rather than leave, he wanted to use that fame to speak out against totalitarianism, to speak out about what was happening to the average Russian. And he continued doing this as far as he could anyway, once Vladimir Putin came in. He retired from chess, or playing it competitively, in 2005. He says here in this article, today I live in exile, New York City, driven there not by the Soviets, but by a bloodthirsty Putin regime that has no ideology beyond power and money. Power and money. But see, we can be nice to them and make some good deals. Make some good economic deals. That's what Tillerman's done best. I mean, he's made money for Russia. And Russia's made money for Tillerson. And so he's had just an excellent relationship with Vladimir Putin. Kasparov says, look, I live in exile in New York City, driven there by this bloodthirsty Putin regime that has no ideology beyond power and money. He says, my medals and awards as a representative of the USSR offered me some safety there, but today my name is being purged from the Russian record books. It's being purged. He concludes here by saying the internet was going to connect every living soul and shine a light into the dark corners of the world. Instead, the light has reflected back to illuminate the hypocrisy and apathy of the most powerful nations in the world. Crimea is annexed. Ukraine is invaded. ISIS is rallying. Aleppo is laid waste. And not one of us can say that we didn't know. We can say only that we did not care. 2.7 billion people still living under the boot of a communist dictator, or at least a dictator. We can't say that we didn't know. All that we can say is that we don't care. We don't care what Putin does to his people. We don't care what Castro does to his people. We don't care so much about what's happening in Aleppo. He says globalization has made it easy for the enemies of the free world to spread their influence in ways the Soviet leadership couldn't have imagined, while the West has lost the will to defend itself and its values. Does that sound familiar? The West has lost the will to defend itself. It's lost the will to advance its values. And so the world today, in 2016, we're very near to flipping the calendar page, heading into 2017. And as I was saying on Friday, we've got to be ready. The intensity, you can feel it. You can sense the urgency in Europe to build the army. All of these ascendant nations, I mean, there's real urgency there. In Europe, in Russia, China, stealing an American drone ship on Friday, just helping themselves to it. And all that America can do in response is to negotiate. I mean, these kinds of acts never would have happened. Imagine them happening under the administration of Ronald Reagan. Or even Margaret Thatcher. Now they're happening all the time. They happen almost weekly. These embarrassing, shameful acts. And it all gets back to this. The West has lost the will to defend itself and its values. 25 years ago, the USSR fell. But that happens to be, as Kasparov brings out in his piece, that's also when the world, particularly the Western world, went to sleep. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming to you live from our headquarters studio in a very cold and frigid Edmond, Oklahoma. Email the program, if you like, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
I've mentioned this example before. I think it was on a program back in October, a couple of months ago, where Herbert Armstrong, once he rejected that salary from, I think it was a $3 per week salary from the Oregon Conference, he was then free to move on and just rely solely on God. And it was early on in that process of relying solely on God that Mr. Armstrong was accosted by a man one day while he was walking between the Fear Butte School and the Jean School there in the Willamette Valley. And this man came up to him and said that he wasn't going to get very far because Mr. Armstrong was preaching straight from the Bible. And that offends people, this fellow said. He said, the Bible's like a sharp two-edged sword. It cuts, it reproves, corrects, rebukes. People won't support that kind of preaching. Well, and that's true. Men don't. Men don't support that kind of message. But the thing of it is, God does. That's what that man didn't understand. Mr. Armstrong did. And he went on to say in his autobiography that I'm not here because I'm relying on the support of people. I mean, if that were the case, I'd have to be out there just serving the people or making it about pleasing the people. But he was in it to serve God. And he looked to God solely for the support, for the backing. He said, I had to rely on God to lay it on the hearts of people to support the kind of preaching that obeys Isaiah 58 and verse 1. And what does it say in Isaiah 58 and verse 1? It says, "Cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins." Show my people their sins. He was called to warn the world, and he knew those that would come into the church in support of the work would support that calling. Well, of course, after his death, you talk about dramatic changes in the world. No more delay. Well, look at what happened inside of God's church. The Worldwide Church of God lost sight of the commission to warn the world. They stopped doing the work. And that church died. That church died. It stopped doing the Isaiah 58:1 message, or delivering that message. Cry aloud, spare not. Notice what my father wrote in the Isaiah booklet in talking about this verse, Isaiah 58:1. He said, "The primary work of God's church is to proclaim Israel's sins." You look at all these events happening in the world. I mean, losing the will. It all gets back to transgressions. It all gets back to Israel's sins. He said in the Isaiah booklet, we're to show the house of Jacob its sins. When God says to show my people their transgression, he's speaking, first of all, to his church. He's speaking, first of all, to his people. I mean, those brethren that were in the Worldwide Church of God, they need this message first and foremost. The Isaiah 58:1 message. I was saying to the students last week in our final assembly that when God says to show my people their sins, he's speaking, first of all, to us, you and me. I mean, we have to make this personal. We have to apply this to ourselves above all. And then when we do, God really opens doors for the work. That's what Mr. Armstrong learned early on. If God is going to use this work to reach this dying world, then we, in support of this work, brethren, members, co-workers, donors, subscribers, readers, listeners, we have to get serious about overcoming sin and conquering our adversary, the devil. He's been cast down, as I said in the first segment. We're in the period of no more delay. We're in the last hour. These are the final moments before Christ returns to this earth. And how is God going to use this church? How is God going to use this work to tell his people about their sins if we aren't bothering to get rid of our own sins? Isaiah 58:2 says, "Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. They seek me daily," Isaiah says, "as a nation," or the Revised Standard says, "as if a nation." God here in verse 2 is condemning hypocrisy. He's saying his people love to think about themselves as being righteous. They delight in their religiosity. Oh, they sure do. For so many people in the Israelitish nations today, and even in the Laodicean church, this time of year is seen as a very religious time of year. I mean, just look at how wildly popular you see it. Like yesterday when I'm traveling, you see it when you travel out and about. Just how popular these customs steeped in Babylonianism, how popular they are today, wildly popular. I mean, so many millions and millions of people believe that Jesus is the reason for this kind of tradition, this season. They lap it up. They thoroughly enjoy all of the trappings of the Christmas feast, the beautiful trees and the colorful lights, the pine cones, the ornaments, the candles, the fancy decorations, the nativity scenes. You look at all the bright colors, the bright clothing, the choir music, the catchy Christmas carols, all the holiday meals, the food, the treats, the candies, the drinking, the presents. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's the kind of feel-good godliness that doesn't come with all of those constraints of law, those do's and don'ts. I mean, it's one thing to drink eggnog or to watch the Nutcracker, but don't come to me about tithe paying. Don't come to me about Sabbath observance. Don't talk to me about what kinds of perverse entertainment we should avoid or what God has to say about sex before marriage or moderation when it comes to drinking and eating. Don't come to me about what God expects with respect to prayer and fasting, with the kind of time commitment he expects to keep the first commandment. It's a lot easier, isn't it, to just feel good about yourself with all of these traditions that seem so nice, that are so pretty, that sound so good, but that require nothing really, in the way of do's and don'ts. This is the way to go. This is not the way to go. This is the way to behave. This is not the way to behave. So Mr. Armstrong comes with a message, quite unlike the message that's wildly popular in so many other churches. He comes with a message that at its core is about crying aloud and sparing not. And that man that accosted him in 1933, he said, you're not going to get far with that kind of a message. People don't want it. Notice what he said in his autobiography. What man could start out without money, without support or backing, without any car, and having to walk or hitchhike on his own with an unpopular message to which people were hostile and expect to get that message preached and published to the millions on all continents around the world? How could this happen? He admitted it is an unpopular message. That's all a part of the miracle. I mean, what man could start out with nothing, hitchhiking early on, out on his own, delivering this unpopular message, and expect that message to get preached, published to the millions on all continents around the world? Well, you could add to what he said there that it all got started during the depths of Great Depression. A Great Depression. What a small beginning. Zechariah 4. God says, don't despise that day of small beginnings. It started in the smallest, crudest possible way, as I said last week. And yet it was filled with power. It was filled with the living Christ. He says further, and I think I quoted some of this for you last week, but he says, pitifully small as this effort was during those first few years, still it was, though assuredly not then apparent, the very work of the living God, He says the divinely imparted dynamic spark was in it. People have asked in recent years, what makes this now great work tick? The vital energy and life that the living Christ has imparted is what makes it tick. God, you see, from the very beginning, gave it life. He's the one who gave it power. The power of the Spirit. But he gives that power, as Acts 5:32 says, to those who obey him. Mr. Armstrong himself, I mean, he wasn't a perfect man, but he was obedient to God's laws. He wasn't in some kind of feel-good religion. He was really serious about studying God's commandments and then striving with God's help to live according to God's laws and to overcome sin and to live in humble obedience to God and his laws. Notice further, Isaiah 58, verse 3, I'll read from the Revised Standard Version. It says here, why have we fasted and you see it not? Why have we humbled ourselves and you take no knowledge of it? He's just continuing on with this nation that views itself as if it's God's nation, as if it's God's people. And it continues in verse 3, why have we fasted and you see it not? Why have we humbled ourselves and you take no knowledge of it? Behold, in the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasure and oppress all your workers. Well, you're just doing it for yourselves. It's just all a self-righteous show. It's surface. It's just on the surface. It's shallow religion. It's like the Pharisees fasted. Remember the one in Luke 18 who went up to pray and said he was just so thankful that he was not like that dirty publican, because he was much more righteous. He has to be in a right attitude. Verse 4 says, behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with a wicked fist. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice to be heard on high. See the connection there? Verse 1, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice. Lift up your voice. And God says in verse 4, fasting like what you're doing is not going to make your voice to be heard on high. So you study Isaiah 58. You see that mission in verse 1. And then you see from the rest of the chapter how we ought to live, what kind of people we ought to be. There's a direct connection between fasting, prayer, humbling ourselves, doing it with this kind of attitude described in Isaiah 58 and what it says there in the first verse, lifting up our voice with strength. He says in verse 5, is it such a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Eternal? Do you hear anything about this in our society today, particularly around this time of year? Is this a fast I've chosen, God says? It has to be a day of afflicting the soul, humbling ourselves. Verse 6 says, is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? God wants us to loose the bands of wickedness in our fast. He wants us to see ourselves for what we are. He wants us to change. He wants us fasting and praying in this kind of attitude. He says in verse 7, is it not to deal your bread to the hungry, and that you bring the poor that are cast out to your house, when you see the naked and cover him, and you hide your and you hide not yourself from your own flesh. This is the kind of fast that God chooses, one that will benefit the world, one that will amplify that message, that cry aloud, spare not message to the hungry souls in this world, to the poor and the ignorant who don't know. This is the kind of fast that God chooses. This is the kind of fast that he's looking for, going before him in a humble, self-searching attitude, striving to root out lawlessness, and intent on drawing closer to God. That's what it's all about. There's an account in Matthew 9 when the disciples of John came to Christ and said, "Well, why do the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus' response was that the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, or can the friends mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? He says, but the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast. In other words, they're going to need to fast to stay close to God and to Jesus Christ. Once the bridegroom is taken away from them, that's what fasting does, if it's done in a right attitude, is it draws us closer to God. And the closer we are to God, the better equipped we'll be to fulfill that Isaiah 58:1 mission. It says in verse 8, "Then shall your light break forth as the morning, and your health shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear reward, or your rear guard or protection." The light will really break forth. That's what happens when God's people come together in unity and dig into the Word of God and find out the do's and the don'ts and then humble themselves in fasting and prayer. Doors will break open for the work. There are constraints, of course, when it comes to God's way of life. There are do's and don'ts there in the Ten Commandments. But look at the rewards. Look at the rewards God gives to us for obedience. Verse 9 says, "Then shall you call, and the Lord shall answer. You shall cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity." See, this is how we can really effectively support God's work. This is how we can effectively fast for God and his work. Verse 10, "If you draw out your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall your light rise in obscurity, and your darkness be as the noonday. And the Lord shall guide you continually, and satisfy your soul in drought, and make fat your bones. And you shall be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not." If we fast with this kind of attitude, if we pray to God with this kind of humility, doors for the work will break open. And then we'll find ourselves growing all the more. Verse 12, it goes on and talks about building for God, and it extends the vision even into the wonderful world tomorrow. The last couple of verses there talk about Sabbath observance as well. I mean, this is the way. This is the way that God wants us to walk, and it keeps us strong, and it opens doors for God's work. Well, I'll have to leave it to you to study further the last part of that chapter. And also, as I told the students last week, you should read, if you have the time to study along with that, Isaiah 58. Look at the whole fourth chapter of James as well with respect to this study on how we can better support that mission, that Isaiah 58 verse 1 mission. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we kick off another week of broadcasting here on KPCG.FM. Email the show, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.